When we come to learn some new art or endeavor to become proficient in some task that requires the mastery by the brain over the muscles, then you can see just how perfect is the attunement of our minds with our muscles. It is not really a mastery of the one over the other, although I have expressed it in that way. To be more accurate, it is an absolute attunement, the one with the other. Now with you on earth, the effort of walking makes imperative the use of various muscles. First, you have a heavy body to move along the ground on which you are standing, and you have certain laws of gravity which are pulling you towards that ground. The gravity is so adjusted that your feet will fall to the ground easily without requiring any effort to push them down. The matter is nicely balanced. When your legs are tired after prolonged use, they will fall the more readily to the ground than when you are fresh. Who upon earth has not experienced at some time or another that great heaviness of the limbs consequent upon fatigue? It is one of our constant joys that we never suffer from such disabilities. There is a law of gravity here in the spirit world, but we are not subservient to it. All else is, but we human beings are not so. Or to put it another way, our minds can and do at all times rise above it. That again is second nature to us. If we should tumble down, we cannot hurt ourselves because our spirit bodies are impervious to all injury in whatever shape or form. Incidentally, we do not often fall because we have not the heavy and rather clumsy bodies that are essential upon earth. It is mostly newly arrived folk who do the tumbling. When we have become fully acquainted with the power and force of our minds, we never do such awkward things. I am afraid this must seem rather a long way towards answering the question as to how we move ourselves instantaneously from one place to another. But you know how simple questions demand the consideration of other factors not unconnected with the original question in order to make the answer to the latter intelligible. Hence, therefore, my seeming deviation and protractedness. The laws of gravity will keep all the inanimate objects of the spirit world in the place where they properly belong, the buildings, the rivers, the sea, and the rest. It will keep us there, too, but only in the qualified sense that I have just mentioned to you. Remember that on earth your mind is limited in certain directions by the abilities, or disabilities of the physical body. If, say, you wish to write something down, your hand and your arm must be in a fit condition to do so. The same rule applies to the rest of your body. To walk, your legs and feet, and indeed, many other parts of the body, must be in a moderately sound state to do so. The speed at which your limbs can move is not limited by the wishes of the mind, but by the ability of the limbs to move. The performer upon a musical instrument knows how true this is from the unremitting practice which he has perforce to do before his hands can move at the speed which the music makes necessary. In the spirit world, our bodies are always in a state of absolute perfection of condition. The muscles and the various parts of our bodies will respond as instantly and as rapidly as we wish the moment we set the thought in motion. We set the thought in motion. The thought sets the limbs and its parts in motion. There is no lagging, no perceptible fraction of a moment between our thought and its action. It will recall to your mind the familiar phrase, "To think is to act." That is literally what takes place in the spirit world. Some of our actions are subconscious, as I have indicated to you, breathing, for example. We do not have to learn how to do that. My mention of breathing has brought me to a point in our discussion where I think it would be acceptable if I were to speak to you upon the subject of what we both know as the spirit body. There are particular aspects about it upon which one of my friends upon earth has expressed the wish for further information. I am happy to give it to the best of my ability, but I would limit myself, as I have done throughout the whole of these writings, to knowledge which has been gained by my own experience. My reason for the latter is simply that it could be reasonably inferred that I might have recourse to the many books of learning upon all subjects that are to be found within the library of the Great Hall of Learning. In effect, I should merely have to look things up in any work devoted to the subject under consideration. I have recounted to you how we have the truth here reposing between the covers of thousands of volumes. One has only to consult these, it might be said, to become possessed of an immensity of knowledge upon all subjects under the sun. Thus one could soon ascertain the literal truth upon so many of the questions that have puzzled generations of students and inquirers. The truth is there in those books, certainly, but information of a highly technical nature is not to be gleaned merely for the reading. We must understand something, in many cases a good deal of our subject, before we can plunge into technicalities which a full exposition of the truth will disclose. I must, therefore, know and understand my subject before I can pass on the information and knowledge with any hope of your understanding it. How, otherwise, am I to know that I have given you the correct answer to a question? It is the only satisfactory course to you, who have followed me so patiently thus far, and to me, that I should know what I am talking about, and so give you only those things of which I have specific knowledge or experience. I have hitherto always tried to make it clear when I am only expressing a personal opinion, and when I am quoting from the knowledge and experience of my friends in the spirit world. And now let us proceed with our friend's question. My friend of the earth recalls my account of the orchestral concert which I attended here, and he says that if people play wind instruments in the spirit world, they must have lungs that are capable of breathing air. And so he asks, do people breathe in the spirit world? If so, are the lungs used for oxygenating the blood? Such reasoning is perfectly accurate. The spirit world has air just as you have on earth, and we have lungs in our bodies with which to breathe it. And it does oxygenate the blood in what would be the spirit world equivalent of that process. Upon earth, the air you breathe will help to purify the blood. In the spirit world we have good rich blood running through our veins, and we breathe a beautiful clean fresh fragrant air, but while your blood undergoes the process of oxygenating, our blood is reinvigorated by the spiritual force and energy that is one of the principal constituents of the air we breathe here. Could one exist without it? Hardly. It gives us a measure of life force just as it does you on earth. But you could not exist upon air alone. You must have food and drink. We do not need these two latter commodities, as you know, but we derive another part of our sustenance from the light of these realms, from the abundance of color, from the water, from the fruit when we wish to eat of it, from the flowers, and from all that is beautiful itself. As these realms positively abound in beauty, you will see why we enjoy such perfect health. But we also take in strength from the great spiritual force that is being constantly poured down upon us all from the Father of Heaven himself. It is, as it were, an eternal magnetic current that is forever charging us with force and power, and giving us life. It really comes to this, that we derive our life force from a score of different sources, moreover, that we do not have to seek as do with your food and drink, but which literally envelope us wherever we go, whatever we do. We cannot shut ourselves off from the means of life, nor can the means of life be denied us or ever fail us here. The air we breathe cannot become polluted, nor can the water become in a similar state of impurity. The earthly body is so constituted that through various processes and natural functions a firm resistance is made to the onslaught of germs that cause disease. When it is behaving normally and properly, such disease will be successfully repelled. But even though the earthly body should successfully resist disease, the potential causes of it, the germs, still remain in the earth world. In the spirit world there are no such things as germs of any description, therefore there can be no disease of any sort whatever. Moreover, the spirit body is completely impervious to any kind of injury. It cannot be damaged by accident, and it is imperishable and incorruptible. So that whatever organs we possess, they can never become disordered in the slightest degree. We are constantly enjoying a state of perfect health, upon which there are no two opinions among all of us here in these realms. The slightest trace of ache or pain is something not only unheard of, but from our point of view, fantastically impossible. It is obvious from what I have told you that one or two organs of the earthly body would be manifestly superfluous in the spirit body. We do not eat food because we are never hungry. There is therefore no waste that has to be eliminated from our bodies, as is essential with your physical bodies. The food that you eat goes through its processes after you have consumed it to provide what is necessary for the physical body until it finally becomes waste matter. And to perform this series of actions, various organs are vital. We possess an interior mechanism which follows much upon the same lines as does yours, but there is this supreme difference, namely, that we have no waste matter that must be eliminated from the body. There is no such thing as waste matter in these realms. That which is not wanted either ceases to exist altogether, or is returned to the source whence it came. By ceasing to exist, I do not mean that which is not wanted is annihilated, but that it ceases to exist in the form it held before it became unwanted. Perhaps you will recall an amusing experience which I had shortly after my arrival here. I told you how astonished I was to find that the juice which had poured from some fruit that I was eating, and had, so I thought, run down my clothing, had, in fact, done nothing of the sort. It had completely disappeared. All that had happened in this case was simply that the juice of the fruit had returned to the tree whence the fruit had come. That is the explanation I was given, and that is what we all know to occur in any other circumstances of a similar nature. If you ask me how it happens, then, perforce, I will say honestly that I do know. Lest my ignorance should appear too great that I should ever set myself to inform others, let me hasten to add that there is no one in these realms who could provide an explanation upon this point. There is no esoteric secret about it that such information should be withheld from us. It is just that our spiritual evolutions has not proceeded sufficiently far for us to understand if we were told. What we cannot yet understand ourselves, it is impossible for us to expound for your understanding. The organs that we possess, therefore, have their very definite purpose for their existence. We do not carry about with us organs that are redundant. Their purpose is to act as a channel for the life force, the etheric power, if you wish to call it so, that emanates from a multiplicity of sources. There is no fear that some organs, or all of them, will become atrophied because they do not seem to be employed in the same manner as their counterparts in the earthly body. The organs of assimilation of the earthly body will become seriously affected if a sufficient quantity of food is not passed through them. No such situation could arise in our spirit bodies, because the life force here amply sustains them, and keeps them in proper working order, and thus they fulfill their objects. The spirit body, then, possesses only such organs as are vital to it, and they can be regarded as a modification of their earthly counterparts. The further significance of this will be plainer to you when I tell you that, with the exception of the higher and highest realms, the spirit world, in which millions upon millions of us are living, is populated entirely from the earth, and from no other source. Procreation belongs to the earth, and has no place in the spirit world. It has become a habit to begin the counting of time by some supposed date of the creation of the world. Time, in its measured sense, can be said to have commenced with the formation of the earth, but human life was already in existence long before then. The spirit world was long in existence before the earth, but the spirit world was not empty. It was inhabited by great souls whose knowledge and wisdom and spiritual progression and evolution have been proceeding steadily throughout the whole of this colossal period of time. All these beings possess a body which in its parts and its functions are exactly similar to the body of any one of us here, regardless of our position upon the ladder of spiritual progression, though, under certain conditions, that body would appear outwardly to us infinitely lesser beings as a blaze of light. The spirit body which we all possess is the normal body. The earthly body, which temporarily covers the spirit body during its earthly passage, is a modification of the spirit body, an accommodation to earthly laws and conditions and modes of life. The life of the individual begins upon earth, it spends a limited period in that sphere, and then comes to us in the spirit world. The personality and individuality and attributes of the person are in their initial stages of formation upon earth, and the process is continued after his arrival in the spirit world. The physical distinctions of race will be preserved, borne upon his face, in the very color of his skin, and in other ways that will readily occur to you, and these he will retain in the spirit world. The true sphere of life is the spirit world because it is permanent. The spirit world is therefore the standard of life as it is ultimately to be for us all, and so the spirit body, not the earthly body, is the standard of a human form. In company with many others I have seen and spoken to at least one illustrious being whose period of life, in years, reaches astronomical figures. He possesses, just as do you or I, the ordinary normal complement of limbs. He has hair upon his head. His hands, anatomically like yours and mine, have their full number of fingernails. And so we might go on, through the complete catalogue of the parts of the human anatomy as it exists in the spirit world. The exalted nature of his being and the elevated realm in which he resides make no difference, anatomically, from the rest of us. His spirituality and wisdom and knowledge are, of course, in their high degree incomparable with us here. But we are not considering that for the moment. What we are considering is that when man, who has lived upon earth, comes to the spirit world to continue his life here, he sheds with his earthly body all such organs of that body as will be superfluous in his new mode of living. The organs with which he now finds himself are forever beyond harm of every description. No germ can attack the body, no destructive force can exert the slightest influence upon it. It is incorruptible. Its various organs, such as the heart and lungs, act perfectly. For example, the beating of the heart remains constant and normal under all conditions. We cannot literally become breathless. I have sometimes said that some particular experience has left me breathless almost. But this is a figure of speech only. Our respiration, like the action of the heart, remains always at its normal rate. And so it is throughout the rest of our bodies. I do not pretend to the knowledge of a physician or a surgeon, but I do know that my body functions perfectly, that I enjoy, as we all enjoy, a state of perfect health such as I never for one moment enjoyed during my life on earth. Indeed, it is impossible to know what absolute, perfect health can be until one comes to live here in the spirit world. The body I possess is not a hollow drum, a mere empty vessel in the ownership of which I am able, in some mysterious fashion, to carry on my life. There is good rich blood flowing through my veins. There is no doubt about that, for I can observe the flesh pink tinge it gives to my skin, as it does to us all. We have the complexions of healthy individuals, though the former may vary in the depth of their color by virtue of the various racial characteristics which you can easily call to mind. Whatever may be the precise shade of our complexions or of our skin in general, we none of us have the pallor that is usually associated either with a poor state of health or with some particular form of earthly occupation. The circulation of the blood within our bodies is the means of diffusing the vital force that keeps us alive. If you should ask me why it should be necessary to have these organs to do this work, then I can only say that it is impossible for me to explain the fact of human creation itself. We might ask in turn, why does the incarnate person have his organs to do such work as is required of them? We should have to go to the very beginning and ask why has man come to be in the form that is familiar to us, and not in some other form. We must take things as they are in this instance at least. To do otherwise is rather to suggest that we could make several improvements upon the anatomy of our bodies were we given the opportunity. As far as we, in the spirit world, are concerned, no improvement could possibly be made upon the structure and operation of our spirit bodies. And I think that in these very bodies we have at least one assured example of perfection in our midst, and which we enjoy now. The greater perfection, I use this phrase in accordance with the terms of our previous discussion upon perfection, the greater perfection that awaits us when we proceed to a higher realm is a spiritual perfection, and will not apply to the state of health of our bodies. We may feel so much lighter, more etherealized, more ratified, but as far as I have been able to ascertain, we shall feel in a precisely similar state of buoyant, brilliant health as we do now in these realms. It is manifestly impossible for me to take every organ of the body and deal with its particular functions in due order. What we can do, to sum up the matter briefly, is to reflect upon this. The spirit body is possessed of organs that are proper to it and to the world in which it carries out its functions. The earthly body will answer to the same description in its own sphere of action. The spirit body, coming first in the order of creation, is the standard of human form and figure. The earthly body resembles it, but it is certain other organs added by which it carries out certain processes that are essential to its continued survival upon earth. The two principles of these processes are the means of assimilating food and the means of perpetuating human life upon earth. Food we do not need in the spirit world, and the population of spirit lands is derived, with the exception of those beings in the higher and highest realms to which I have referred, entirely from the earth insofar as the spirit universe is concerned. In discarding my earthly body at my physical dissolution, I found that my spirit body was without certain organs, the possession of which would be entirely redundant. Such organs have no counterpart in or upon the spirit body. A question may naturally be asked as to how we can live with some of our organs missing. The answer is that they are not missing, they were never there. The spirit body performs perfectly because it is perfectly constructed, complete in all its parts, and only possesses such organs as it requires, in number slightly less than those required by the earthly body. Now we come to another question from our same good friend, which is away altogether from the contemplation of our bodies, and concerns the intellectual side of life here. He asks in effect, how is it that a person who was a clergyman during his earthly life and who was a firm upholder of his church's teachings and of what is orthodox in religious manners, how is it that such a person can, in communicating with the earth, give every sign imaginable of having quickly thrown off his religious beliefs and his orthodoxy? The same question could apply to a large number of people to a greater or less degree according to the views which they held upon earth. Orthodoxy is not the only thing that can mentally and intellectually shackle a being on earth. Religious beliefs, both orthodox and unorthodox, can exert a most powerful hold upon the minds of human beings. The former, in general, are too widely known to need amplification, but of the latter, the unorthodox, there are many forms. A great many people hold that a firm belief in a book of ancient chronicles, without even remotely understanding a tithe of its contents, is fully sufficient to assure them of a safe journey to the next world, and the certainty of a residence in some salubrious spot among the elect. Some people hold that a staunch belief in the merits of another will achieve the same results. Whatever form these beliefs take, they are most of them of the crudest description, and upon arrival in the spirit world, the ardent upholders of the childish creeds discover their true worth, which is precisely nothing. Now it is exactly according to the mental and intellectual makeup of an individual when he arrives in the spirit world as to how long it will take him to shake off the erroneous beliefs and mistaken ideas which he has accumulated during his life on earth. The person with an open mind, provided that mind is not to open and therefore to easily swayed in one direction after another without perceiving the truth, such a person will the more quickly see what his new life involves in the matter of altered outlook. If he is ready to throw off the old life at once and takes up the new life with equal clarity, then so much the better and happier will that person be. It is possible of achievement. Many, many times have Edwin, Ruth, and I witnessed this very thing happening. You can appreciate how we rejoice and our new friend with us, at this quick awakening to the truth. It is good for us all, and especially it reduces hard work to a minimum. But some people are very stubborn. They will scarcely credit the evidence of their own senses, and are therefore not very disposed to place much reliance upon our assurances and observations when we try to explain just what the new life means to them. Time will work its usual wonders, and so we are not in any great hurry when we find that an individual appears likely to require some convincing. To come more specifically to the terms of our friend's question, it depends upon what is meant by quickly as regards the time taken by an inhabitant of the spirit world to abandon orthodox religious views. Here we are measuring time in earthly terms. A few hours taken to achieve this end would doubtless seem the extreme of rapidity in which to relinquish beliefs that have been held for a lifetime. But with the right type of mind it could be done. Indeed, it has been done on many occasions to which I can bear witness of personal experience. The age of the new arrival must also be taken into consideration, whether he, or she, be young, middle-aged, or elderly. So you see, there are a number of factors to be taken into account, either singly or in conjunction with each other. There is, for instance, another element which will weigh in the matter: how firmly were the beliefs held? Were they deep-rooted, or merely superficial? People will sometimes make a demonstration of holding certain religious beliefs because they have been brought up in those beliefs from childhood. They may not have bothered to think very much for themselves, and so they have proceeded through their earthly life in an easy fashion religiously, not really caring, but content to follow the rest of the family in their practices. So much for general terms. I can, however, speak from my own personal experience. During my earthly life I was a clergyman of the Orthodox Church, but I was not entirely ignorant of the presence around me of an invisible world over which, so it appeared to me, my church had no jurisdiction whatever. My own psychic faculties were not very powerful, but at least they were strong enough for me to disbelieve what my church most emphatically taught in this connection, namely, that such manifestations as I was permitted to see were all the work of the devil. Now here I could perceive no evidence at all of diabolic intervention. What I did see was decidedly harmless in every way. I therefore frankly disbelieved what the church taught me and told me to teach others upon the subject. But I did not voice this disbelief. That was a secret which I carried with me into the spirit world. I should have done no good had I expressed what I thought openly. And so I kept these discoveries to myself. Naturally, I believed in a future state of life, and what I saw for myself, psychically, confirmed that belief. Secretly, I differed from the church in its attitude towards such experiences as I had had, but at the same time I chose to consider my own position in the world. The church's hold upon me was a powerful one, and this hold was made the stronger by the absence of greater and wider experiences of a psychic nature such as so many of my friends upon earth are enjoying at this present moment. I was prepared in my own mind for surprises of considerable magnitude, ready, more or less, to reconstruct my whole outlook, ready, if need be, to jettison my orthodox views in the light of the truth, whatever it might be. While I was still upon earth I tried to steer an even course between the little knowledge I had managed to glean of psychic matters concerning the afterlife and the church's teachings. In my mind the church's teachings weighed more heavily in the scale than did my scanty knowledge of psychic things, but I was fully prepared to find conditions totally different from the hereafter as sketchily touched upon by the church. I had the great authority, at least, I thought it to be great, of the church behind me in whatever religious matters I spoke upon publicly in my preaching. I had no authority behind me in my psychic experiences. Indeed, those to whom I related these experiences to, at once pronounced me as being tempted by the devil. Some there are, I dare say, who will say that I should have braved all, pursued my investigations farther and deeper, and abided by the result. The result, they would say, would have been inevitable. I should have discovered that the church's teachings were fundamentally wrong, and then it would have been the right and proper thing for me to renounce the church in favor of the truth as revealed to me through communication with the great spirit world. I wish that I had done so. However, as events have transpired, I have nothing to regret now. Through the kind offices of devoted friends and companions I have been enabled to attain to a state of happiness such as I never believed could be possible. When I had reached the end of my journey upon earth and I found myself at last in the great world upon which I had contemplated so often and so deeply, there to find myself in the very presence of an old friend and colleague who had predeceased me by some years, I think it is true to say that I was prepared for anything, although I had no notion just what it might be. What happened after this meeting I have already set down. It required but half a night to see that the church was wrong in so much that it had taught me, and which in turn I had taught others.